The following podcast contains spoilers and graphic content. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to Criminal Adaptations, the show where we take a look at some of your favorite movies and the true crime stories that inspired them. I'm Ashley. I'm a clinical psychologist and forensic evaluator in the state of Oregon.
And I'm Remy. I spent over a decade working in the film and television industry in Los Angeles, California.
And today we are going to be covering part one of our two-part season finale. This week we are going to be discussing Truman Capote and Richard Brooks in Cold Blood, the quadruple murder of the Clutter family in the late 1950s.
This is a movie I had never seen before and a book I have never read before. I have only really known this story tangentially through seeing the Capote film with Philip Seymour Hoffman several years back at this point. I remember being very engaged with that film, and I remember thinking he had a magnificent performance. Now seeing the actual film and knowing a lot more about it, I have a lot to say, and I feel like I've already learned a lot just from watching the film.
I have not seen the movie, obviously. It's a very old film, but I had read the book before many, many years ago. I think back in college, I've always been a pretty avid reader, and this one is one that everyone has heard of. It really started America's fascination with true crime. Truman Capote was one of the first people to write a nonfiction novel, which is the format of his book, In Cold Blood. Reading it for the second time, I was as engaged with it as I was the first time I read it. He has an amazing writing style. The book is filled with pretty much every single detail that you would ever want to know about this crime, and the families and individuals involved, all the individuals involved. And it is just a fantastic, fantastic book.
Yeah, I don't really know a tremendous amount about Capote just yet. We haven't done that part two of the podcast, but I will be very well informed by this time next week, I'm sure.
Yes, I've already about two-thirds of the way through of this like 500-page biography that the movie Capote is based on. All I'm going to say about Truman at this point is he led a fascinating life. So it will be a nice deviation from talking about a specific crime and more talking about a person who is a huge personality and really, I personally think, had a lot to do with starting this true crime obsession America has and the whole world has with true crime at this point.
Yes, I believe this is almost our love letter to Capote. He was really the one who brought this sort of thing of true crime into the public knowledge. Yeah, we would not be here without him. He is one of the people that pioneered this. I think it's only fair that we talk about the crime that started it all, really.
And he also really brought into the zeitgeist this style of the nonfiction fiction book. I've read a couple other ones that are in that sort of style. The biggest one that comes to mind is Devil in the White City. And the same author had written The Killers of the Flower Moon, I believe what it's called. The movie that's coming out, I think, in November with Leonardo DiCaprio, Robert De Niro, Martin Scorsese. It's going to be a doozy.
Yes, and they've been talking about making that Devil in the White City movie forever. I think Leonardo DiCaprio was even attached for a really long time. And for whatever reason, that project just never got off the ground. I wish it did. I would love to see a film adaptation of that book.
I think they're still working on it and pushing for it. I check on it every once in a while. And his name, Leo's name, is still attached. For a while, I heard that they had Keanu Reeves in talks of being H.H. Holmes, but he has since dropped out, which is really disappointing. I think Keanu could have done a really interesting work in that role.
Agreed. I would have really liked to see that. I'm sure it will come out someday. We don't know who will play those characters. We are definitely going to do The Killers of the Flower Moon when it is available.
Probably a little bit later, because that is one I do want to watch. I don't want to wait. And I'm not going to make you sit through a 3.5-hour movie twice in a short amount of time.
I completely forgot that it is a 3.5-hour movie. From if rumors are true, it's a 3.5, nearly 4-hour film. So that will be a long episode, I would imagine. That is way down the road. We are here today to talk about In Cold Blood. Are you ready to hear the Richard Brooks version of In Cold Blood?
Yes, let's get into it.
In Cold Blood is a 1967 crime film written, produced, and directed by Richard Brooks. Based on Truman Capote's 1966 nonfiction book of the same name, it stars Robert Blake as Perry Smith and Scott Wilson as Richard Dick Hickok. Director Richard Brooks was actually one of the many casual acquaintances of Truman Capote and was even given early drafts of his book In Cold Blood before it had been completed. In fact, Capote was already considering optioning the book for a film adaptation long before his novel had ever landed in bookstores. Brooks would go on to purchase the film rights for In Cold Blood from Capote for an estimated sum of somewhere around $400,000. Though Brooks's screenplay followed closely to the structure of Capote's book, his adaptation would also incorporate many of Brooks's own personal beliefs against the death penalty and the indignity of capital punishment, as he put it. Brooks would go on to comment, "I think the crime without motive is really what this is about. The crime itself was senseless. The boys' lives before that were senseless. And the end is senseless because it solves nothing." Brooks would also include a reporter character who functions as sort of a Greek chorus for the film, but was not present in Capote's book. Capote would later admit he felt that the character's inclusion in the film didn't make sense. Brooks also omitted two of the Clutter daughters who were not present during the attacks and had thus survived. Brooks claimed this decision was made due to both daughters apparently being distraught by the book and the prospect of an impending film adaptation. So instead, Brooks chose to cut the girls from the film version entirely. Aspiring to create a documentary aesthetic for the film, Brooks deliberately cast actors who were relative unknowns at the time. Though Columbia Pictures had originally campaigned for Paul Newman and Steve McQueen to be cast as Richard Hickok and Perry Smith, respectively, however, Brooks felt that their star statuses would render their performances less believable to audiences, and later commented, "I love Paul, but that's the problem. Everybody loves Paul. He's not scary." Which I do agree.
I had also read that Frank Sinatra was tied to the movie for a bit as an undisclosed character.
Yeah, I know they were campaigning for big Hollywood names in this, but the director was very against it, and I think it was the right move in the end. The only thing I found distracting about these two actors is the actor who plays Dick is also the same actor who played Herschel on The Walking Dead. I found that a little distracting, but he is very young in the film, and he looks a lot like a young Edward Norton, we agreed.
Yeah, I encourage everyone to take a moment and Google what young Scott Wilson looked like, because he was a straight 10. He was extremely attractive.
Yes, he was very, very good in the role as well. Very charismatic. It's crazy that this is the same person who's the, you know, old man in Walking Dead. It's just crazy. Over 500 actors were considered for the roles of the notorious criminals Perry Smith and Dick Hickok, with newcomers Robert Blake and Scott Wilson ultimately being cast in the roles. Though Blake had originally worked as a child actor, he was not yet well known at the time for his work as an adult. Scott Wilson had only one prior feature film credit to his name, but was personally recommended for the part by both famed actor Sidney Poitier and legendary music producer Quincy Jones. Those are some good people to have in your corner campaigning for you to have a role, I would think.
Yeah, no kidding.
In order to add authenticity to the project, Richard Brooks chose to use actual locations and characters from the real-life events whenever possible. This included filming in and around locations all over Kansas City, including the original Clutter House where the murders took place and the same courtroom where the two men were sentenced. Though permission was denied for filmmakers to shoot inside Kansas State Penitentiary, where the two men had been imprisoned, as a result, these specific scenes had to be recreated in Los Angeles using a Hollywood soundstage. However, the actual leather straps from the men's execution, as well as the prison officers' uniforms, were purchased from the penitentiary and used for the film.
My mind was blown. I didn't know that about the prison straps, but my mind was blown when I read in the Capote book that I'm currently reading that they had actually filmed in the house. That is wild.
Yes, we have covered a lot of films that have gone to real locations where events took place. I believe this is the first one that they actually went to the place where the murders actually happened. Usually, those locations are, you know, out of respect, they aren't used. This was, at the time, the first film doing this sort of thing, and yeah, they actually filmed in the house where those four people were murdered. They also managed to get a hold of Perry and Dick's actual prison latrines, which were both also used on film. Several other real-life aspects were also added to the film, including actual photos of the Clutter family appearing throughout the scenes taking place inside the Clutter home. I did notice this in the film because some of the actors do not necessarily resemble the members of the Clutter family. So in pictures where it's the husband and wife, it is a bit more obvious that it is not those two actors. And I read about this after the fact. I couldn't imagine being on set and having the victims' own faces looking at you in the house where they died while you are trying to film a recreation of those deaths. I couldn't imagine. I would feel so uncomfortable in that sort of situation. I couldn't do that sort of thing. That's too much for me.
I imagine for some, it would really spark more desire to really put forth a believable and your best acting performance.
I would say yes to that, but the Clutter family are really not characters in this film. Any sort of authenticity or that would be brought to their performance from having that sort of thing around, it's not shown on film. They are really not the focus of the film. The killers are the main and only focus, really. For the movie's poster, the two pairs of eyes pictured are those of the real killers and not the actors who were portraying them. Brooks would choose to shoot the film in black and white as he felt that color would be far too romantic for such a bleak story. 7 of the original 12 jurors, as well as the hangman of the real-life events, were also utilized in the filming of this movie as well.
And Nancy's horse, Babe.
That's a sweet name for a horse. I remember the horse scenes. They were unexpected and pleasant.
Yeah, they ended up selling the horse, obviously. Everything of the Cutler residence was auctioned, and so Babe was brought out of retirement to film this movie.
Richard Brooks's demeanor on set was described as focused and inspired, but unpredictable, like a volcano who was going to erupt at some point. In a quote, Robert Blake said this about Brooks. Sometimes Richard would flare up and get nuts and crazy and start screaming at people, and people thought that was because he was an asshole. It wasn't that. He was just frustrated. He didn't know how to get what he wanted, but when he sat alone at a typewriter, that was the best part for him. The score of the film was composed by Quincy Jones, who at the time actually had very little experience composing film scores. I told Ashley about this, and she's not familiar with Quincy Jones, but is very familiar with his daughter, Rashida Jones, from The Office and Parks and Rec. Jones would utilize two acoustic basses throughout the score as a representation of the two killers' demented minds. Here is a little sample of that soundtrack by Mr. Jones. And with that, are you ready to get into Richard Brooks's In Cold Blood?
Yes, let's talk about this horrific crime.
Our story begins in the evening with a bus traveling to Kansas City. A man sits in the back with his face shrouded in shadows as he casually strums his guitar. The man lights a cigarette, illuminating the face of Perry Smith, being played by Robert Blake, as the film's score dramatically swells. We then cut to a small farm where we meet Perry's eventual partner, Dick Hickok, outside of a rickety old outhouse, tending to his father, who is currently in the midst of a coughing fit. Dick tends to his father, but has to leave him shortly, as he tells the old man that he has plans for the day to drive up to Kansas City to help an old friend. After Dick's father is out of eyesight, Dick retreats into a small shed and retrieves a shotgun wrapped in a blanket that he stashes in the back of his vehicle. Perry finally arrives in Kansas City, looking much like a greaser from the 1950s. Like the movie Grease or Fonzie, you know, leather jacket, black hair, all slicked back, that sort of thing.
West Side Story.
Exactly. After exiting the bus, Perry wanders around for a little bit before eventually reading a letter he had stashed away in his coat pocket written to him from Dick. The letter seems to imply that Dick has invited Perry to meet up in Kansas City on November 14th so that they can pull off some sort of a job together that Dick promises is a sure thing that will pay off big time. Elsewhere, we are introduced to the Clutter family, with daughter Nancy and father Herbert being played by Brenda Curran and John McLeam. We then meet Herbert's teenage son, Kenyon, being played by Paul Hugh, who is off sneaking cigarettes and pretending to work on something down in the basement, while his mother, Bonnie, played by Ruth Story, is upstairs in her bedroom, just waking up for the day. Back at the bus terminal, Perry makes a phone call to the Kansas State Penitentiary and speaks with Reverend James Post, who advises Perry not to break parole. Perry then retreats into a nearby public restroom, where he washes himself down using the water from one of the sinks. It is here where we first see the nasty scar Perry has that runs down his leg and across his knee, which apparently happened to him back when he was in Korea.
It actually happened, I'll get into this too, after he was out of Korea. He was in a horrific motorcycle accident.
As Perry stares deeply at himself in the restroom mirror, he begins to imagine himself as a headlining musician out in Las Vegas, performing to an audience of empty seats. This daydream is soon interrupted by Dick, who has discovered Perry zoning out in the restroom and jokingly mocks his friend's spacey demeanor. This is a recurring theme for Perry. He is very spacey. He's always daydreaming. He's always fantasizing. He doesn't seem to like being in the present. The two men then drive down the highway where Dick first shows Perry the map to the Clutter home. Dick claims that an old cellmate of his had spilled the beans that there is a hidden safe in the Clutter home containing upwards of nearly $10,000. Dick also claims that he'd have no problem killing all of the inhabitants of the Clutter home who stood in his way that evening. The two men then arrive at a hardware store where they comically get the supplies they intend to use that evening, which include rope, duct tape, and rubber gloves. Now, I say comically not because of the situation, but because the beginning of this movie has absolutely no subtlety whatsoever. I mean, these guys are literally testing out the duct tape and rubber gloves inside the store while nodding and winking at each other. Anyone who saw these two people would immediately know they were planning on tying someone up and restraining them in some way.
Yeah, you had me come out to watch Dick test the tape on his mouth and so, like, takes the rope and, like, starts tying knots with it to, like,
he
test
does.
Them out.
Yeah, they really want to make sure everything works before they pay for it and leave the store. You know, you can't return it after the fact, of course.
Got to make sure you're getting quality duct tape and rope.
Side note here, however, this was the actual store where the real-life killers did purchase these items, and even the shopkeeper is the actual person who had been working there that day, so A-plus again for authenticity here. The two men then leave and continue driving long into the night, but eventually do stop for a bite to eat along the way. Perry says they should go to Mexico after the job is done, and Dick placates his partner but seems to never really have any interest in following through with the idea. Briefly, back at the Clutter home, Herb has just finished signing up for a $40,000 life insurance policy. Now, this may have actually happened, I'm not sure yet, I'm sure you will let me know, Ashley, But I believe the scene was to show us as the audience that this father's life alone was well worth far more than $10,000.
I'll get into this, but the Clutters were a pretty well-off family. And Herb did get a life insurance policy, and it was to help his wife and children in the event of his death. We'll get into this in a bit, but Bonnie was not psychologically stable.
Oh, interesting. Bonnie was bedridden or in her bedroom for most of the times when we saw her. It wasn't really gone into any detail, but I did notice that. Back in the car, Perry confides in Dick that he killed a man back in Las Vegas for no reason at all, so he should have no issues when the time comes to kill yet again. They continue driving, drinking, and chatting away as they cruise through the night on their way to infamy. It is also revealed during this trip that Dick has a son out there somewhere who he has little to no contact with.
Several children, actually. I think he has four.
Wow, he only mentioned the one. They stop to refuel one last time before reaching their destination, where Perry hobbles to the restroom and has to down several aspirin to try and dull the pain from his immense leg injury. Just a few miles up the road, the Clutter family are readying themselves for bedtime. After refueling, Dick and Perry creep methodically up to the Clutter home in their vehicle with the headlights turned off. It is at this point that Perry seems to have a sudden change of heart and advises Dick that they should turn back around. I would say at this point is when the film starts getting interesting. The murder does not happen at this point, if you think that's where I was going with this. The scene abruptly ends as we cut away to the following morning, when a neighboring family arrives at the Clutter home to accompany them to church that day. However, when they arrive, the door to the house has been left wide open and the inside is eerily quiet. When the neighbors enter the home to investigate, what they find causes one of the women to shriek in abject horror. The police are then immediately contacted, and officers are dispatched to investigate the area. What they find is almost too terrible for the officers to have even imagined. Four dead, two upstairs, and two in the basement. Their limbs bound and a bloody footprint left at the scene. Across town, television broadcasts are being interrupted to report on the murders and the preceding manhunt being led by Detective Alvin Dewey, played by John Forsythe. Back at the Clutter house, Detective Dewey and his fellow officers work diligently to collect any evidence they can find. When one of the detectives inquires if the family had a safe in the house where they kept their valuables, he is informed that the Clutter home had no such thing of the sort, and Herb Clutter was notorious for never dealing in cash. We also learn that Herb's throat had been slit, but the family was still seemingly made comfortable before their untimely demise, having been placed on mattresses with pillows while being bound, when they could have just as easily been left on the floor. As of yet, the officers seem unsure whether there were one or two killers or what their motivations could possibly have been. The way they feed out evidence in this film is brilliant, in my opinion. We learn everything very slowly, very tactfully, and it keeps your interest the entire time. It's very, very well done.
I think that was a smart way to go about it because these officers had very little to go on. There was very little evidence at the crime, and for a long time, they were just baffled and just had no idea why this happened, who did this. It just seemed like a senseless crime that was just at a dead end for a bit.
To think of just the lack of resources. I mean, modern day, we have DNA, everybody has a camera. There's so many different things, and this was the 50s, and people had telephones in their home, but that was about it. They were kind of in the middle of nowhere and on a farm-type ranch, and yeah, police literally would have to do this old-school Sherlock Holmes style, where just combing everything for any little clue they can find and investigating the hell out of it. Back at the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, officers review pictures from the crime scene and quickly deduce that there were two killers based on two different footprints left at the scene, which detectives all agree should not immediately be revealed to the media for the time being.
Yeah, they had found that one bloody footprint at the scene, and the next one they didn't even discover until they were looking over the photos, but there was a footprint or a shoe print that was in dust, and just the exposure of the film is what caught that second and only other footprint.
And again, I don't know if this was true of the real life Perry, but his boots that he is wearing are extremely unique. They have indentations on the bottom of them. The soles of his boots are very unmistakable, I would say. They are not just a pair of boots with nothing on the bottom of them. There was actually things like put onto the bottom of these boots. It looked like shotgun shells or bullet shells or something like that.
I think, and I could be wrong, but I think Truman Capote in his book said they were like diamond.
Okay, so yes, it was something that made the soles of his shoes extremely unique. And those were the ones that left the bloody footprint. What the detectives do tell the media is that the murders happened around 2 a.m. the previous night, and that all four family members were killed with the same weapon, a 12-gauge shotgun, with Herb Clutter's throat being slit before he was shot. The victims' mouths were also taped, and they were all tied up using the same nylon rope readily available at any local hardware store. The knots of the ropes were also all tied using the same types of knot often used on cattle farms. Elsewhere, in a seedy hotel room listening to the latest police updates on a stolen radio from the Clutter home are Dick and Perry. Perry is on edge and upset that the two men only made away with $43 after all was said and done. However, Dick still somehow sees this all as a win, as he nonchalantly chows down on some cheeseburgers seemingly without a care in the world.
That just makes this even more sad. It was just such a senseless crime. $40, $10 per person is what these people's lives were worth.
Yeah, they really did not have anything valuable in this home whatsoever. It's truly such a loss. Soon after, a local newspaper offers a reward of $1,000 for any information leading to the apprehension of the two fugitives. This has the unfortunate side effect of the police becoming flooded with false leads from the public in an attempt to claim the reward money. The investigators also seem to be circling the idea that this crime had been a robbery gone wrong, with the only things having been taken being the family radio, a pair of binoculars, and the $43 mentioned earlier. Time passes, and Dick and Perry are now already down to their last $4. In an effort to make some more quick cash, Dick attempts to pull off a charm scam involving the writing of bad checks for some business suits over the total amount owed, and then being given the remaining change back in cash, which proves successful and impresses Perry. So the two men then proceed to travel all over town pulling off the same scam over and over again to great success, I might add.
And then they would go and pawn the stuff they bought. So they were getting this extra cash from these checks and then money for the things they were buying.
Yes, Dick is portrayed as very charming, charismatic, and a jabberjaw. He loves to talk. He's a good talker. He can talk your ear off. He can sell you anything. He's just one of those types.
He was also very intelligent. His IQ was measured at 130, which is two standard deviations higher than the average population.
Meanwhile, the police have finally received a useful tip from an inmate at a state prison in Lansing named Floyd Wells. This was the same man Dick had shared a cell with and had originally told him about the non-existent safe located at the Clutter house. Floyd also tells the police that Dick Hickox planned on robbing the Clutter home after his release and also said that he would kill any witnesses he found inside. This new lead is just what the police needed, and they quickly issue a pickup warrant for Dick on parole violations and passing bad checks so that they can bring him in for questioning. Unfortunately, this also coincides with Perry and Dick's successful escape into Mexico. Still searching for answers, the police continue on by questioning Perry's father, Tex, played by Charles McGraw, who hasn't spoken to his son in the last 5 or 6 years. We also learn that Perry had just been released from a 3-year prison sentence only 6 months ago. Tex would go on to lament the fact that Perry's mother, who had worked in a rodeo, had abandoned Perry and his father by running off and taking Perry's 3 other siblings with her, leaving poor Perry and his dad alone by themselves.
The actual events that unfolded are way sadder than that.
A taste of things to come. Tex continues by coldly stating Perry's mother had died a drunk choking on her own vomit. He has no love at all for Perry's deceased mother, you can tell. Back in Mexico, Perry pitches a plan to Dick about selling the car to buy a boat so that they can follow a map given to him by a local shoeshine boy that supposedly leads to $60,000 in Spanish treasure. That's a crazy sentence if you really just think about it. Perry likes fantasies. He's always dreaming of these treasure maps and explorations and adventures and basically anything that is not reality.
Spoiler alert, they don't find any treasure.
Dick is decidedly against this idea and has already bought them both two tickets back to America so that they can scam some more cash. Back at the Bureau, investigators have begun to consider psychological motives for the crimes beyond just a physical want or need. Their last night in Mexico, Dick has sex with a local girl while Perry drinks tequila alone looking at old photos of him as a kid with his mom and dad. During this, Perry begins to recollect a time when his mother was drunk and making love to another man while Perry and his siblings sat nearby watching the entire ordeal. His mother's lovemaking is then interrupted by Perry's father, Tex, who storms into the room and rips the man off of his wife. Tex then proceeds to beat his wife with a belt while dousing her with liquor. The next day, Dick and Perry have now made their way out of Mexico and are currently hitchhiking down a deserted road to their next destination. Dick says he plans on killing whoever pulls over to pick them up so that they can take their vehicle, but when the time comes, the two men thankfully do not go through with it. In case you can't tell by now, Dick is a lot of talk, but not necessarily a murderous rampage type. Back at Perry's father's Texas shack, one of the detectives is given the shotgun and knife Texas' son Perry may have used during the robbery. That night, now in Iowa, the winds are cold and the rain is strong, forcing Dick and Perry to take refuge in a nearby barn, where the two men start to quibble over what to do next. The men settle on a plan that involves stealing a car, which had been located in the aforementioned barn, so that they can drive to Las Vegas. On the way, they swap license plates with another vehicle and purchase two tires using a bad check. This proves to be the exact slip-up police had been waiting for. When the tire salesman notifies the authorities about a man passing bad checks and takes the initiative to take down the vehicle's license plate number before they had departed. Upon further investigation, the bad check, which had been used to purchase the tires, also matched the same ones Dick had been using earlier before skipping town. Based on this lead, police stake out the Hickok farm in case the two men decide to pay a visit. They also inform toll booths along the route to be on the lookout for the stolen vehicle, but Perry and Dick still do somehow manage to avoid this. Perry even stops along the way to give a little boy and an old man a lift as they scavenge the road for empty bottles to trade in for deposits. It's a pretty cute scene, actually.
It was depicted in the book. I don't really talk about it. How the boy was described in the book, he just seemed just a really sweet, sweet kid. He even offered to split the money they get with Dick and Perry.
Yeah, he was a very cute kid, very nice kid. And it's one of the few just genuinely positive interactions the two men have with other people in this movie. When the two criminals finally do arrive in Las Vegas, they are both presumably apprehended off screen rather abruptly. When we see them next, they are both being let out of their holding cells to be interrogated separately by police. While the two men are being questioned, Dick comes off as cool as a cucumber, while Perry seems quieter and more withdrawn. Though both of their fake alibis seem to be lining up with each other, Dick does the majority of the talking while Perry gives mostly single-word answers or simply responds by saying, "I don't know." However, the facts and details of these two men's stories are easily proven to be false by detectives, and their line of questioning soon shifts over to the Clutter family murders. Eventually, Dick is the one who finally cracks after police show him evidence they've matched the two men's shoe prints to the scene of the crime. Dick confesses, but insists that Perry was the one who murdered the entire family single-handedly. After his confession, Dick immediately passes out. Perry and Dick are then both arrested and charged with the murders of the Clutter family, and we finally flash back to the events of that tragic evening. The two men arrived at around midnight, idling up to the Clutter home with their vehicle's headlights turned off. Once parked, the two men put on surgical gloves, then grabbed their supplies, which included rope, flashlights, and the loaded shotgun. Upon exiting the vehicle, the two men then enter the Clutter home through the unlocked front door. Once inside, The two men search the home for the legendary safe, but repeatedly come up empty-handed. Frustrated, Dick awakens Herb Clutter by shining a flashlight in his eyes, then escorts Herb to his office where he's interrogated as to the whereabouts of the safe. Herb continuously insists that he does not have what the two men are looking for, and as he does, Perry makes his way around the house, disconnecting all the telephone cords. Herb tries placating Dick by handing over all the cash he has on hand, which amounts to just over $30. Herb also tries offering to write the men a check, which Dick immediately scoffs at. While all this is occurring, Perry is made aware that the rest of the family is still sleeping soundly upstairs and informs Dick, who concludes that they should continue on upstairs in an attempt to rob the remaining family members. While forcing Herb to accompany them, the two men enter Herb's wife, Bonnie's, bedroom, who is startled awake as her husband tries to comfort her. Bonnie then confirms to the men exactly what her husband had told them earlier, that they do not, in fact, have a safe. Perry is then ordered to tie up the husband and wife while Dick rounds up the other two children. After the family has been restrained, Dick locks Bonnie and her daughter Nancy in their upstairs bedrooms while he and Perry escort Herb and his son down into the basement. Once downstairs, Perry bounds Herb and his son's feet and gags their mouth with tape while Dick goes back upstairs to continue his futile search for the non-existent safe. Perry then returns upstairs to finish tying the women's feet together. While there, Dick attempts to rape their daughter Nancy, but is stopped by Perry, who orders Dick to go grab a radio from one of the bedrooms and go back downstairs. After remaining behind and speaking to Nancy for just a short while, Perry comes to the conclusion that this entire heist has been an absolute failure before heading back downstairs to the basement. This is where Perry starts hallucinating visions of his abusive father pointing a gun at him as a child, causing him to snap. Perry proceeds to unsheath his knife and slit Herbert's throat before switching over to the shotgun and shooting both Herb and his son in the head with a single shot each, killing them both instantly. Perry then heads back upstairs to the bedroom and does the same to Bonnie and Nancy. Back in the present, Dick and Perry are now on trial for the murders of the Clutter family. It would take 4 hours to pick the jury and 3 days for the state to present its case, while the defense barely needed 90 minutes. In the end, it would only take the jury just 40 minutes to sentence both men to death. Perry and Dick are then both escorted to prison to await their executions in isolation, with their final day being set as Friday, May 13th. But this date would later be delayed due to appeals. Through voiceover, a psychologist hypothesizes that the two men may never have even committed the crimes without the other, and that their two separate personalities would meld into a third whenever the two men would join forces.
Such bullshit.
I knew you would have some comments on that diagnosis. Perry and Dick would go on to wait 5 years on death row, with their case being brought up to the Supreme Court and denied on 3 different occasions. On the night of April 14th, 1965, the two men's sentences are finally carried out and Perry Smith and Dick Hickok are both executed by hanging. Before his death, Perry tells a story to one of the guards assigned to watch over him, and this is probably the best scene of the entire film. Staring out a window with the shadows of the falling rain outside streaking across his face, Perry recounts the time when he and his father had tried opening up a store together after his mom had abandoned them, and the hope such a venture had created within them. Unfortunately, the store would remain empty and close down soon after, leaving his father dejected. In a rage, Perry's father aims a gun at his own child and pulls the trigger, only to realize that it isn't loaded. Perry was then left alone to fend for himself, while his father abandoned him just as the rest of his family had before. And I just need to also comment that the rain on the outside, the shadows of the rain are on Perry's face while he is telling the scene. He is not crying during the scene, but the shadows of the rain make it look like he is. It's beautiful looking, it is tragic, it is a magnificent scene. It's really, really a brilliant scene.
It gave me chills.
Before ascending to the gallows, Perry says he would like to apologize, but doesn't know who he would be apologizing to. And that was Richard Brooks's In Cold Blood. What do you think, Ashley?
I think I want to watch the movie.
Right? It was much better than I thought it would be. I'm a little prejudiced against older films. I don't watch a lot of black and white movies. I don't watch a lot of movies from this specific time period. The acting style is usually a little over the top. It's a little more silly. And the beginning of this film, I would say, is kind of like that. From the part where we skip over the murders and we start to learn about the investigation, this film becomes better and better with every minute. I would say the beginning of this movie for me was like a 2 or a 3, and by the end of this movie, it was a 10. It just builds and builds and builds until the ending scene when Perry is awaiting his hanging. It puts you inside of Perry's mind during that. You can hear his heart beating. You can hear his breathing becoming heavier and heavier. It's just building and building and building until silence. This was back in the day when they would actually do all the opening credits at the beginning of the film. So once Perry dies, that's it. It's just movie over, the end. No credits, no nothing, just that's it. A surprising film that was beautifully directed, wonderfully acted. It was really a surprise. I don't know why I didn't think this movie was going to be that good. Maybe it helped that I had such low expectations, but I thought this movie was amazing. And I'm optimistic that a lot of the details are going to match up to the true story.
I guess that means we need to do more black and white movies moving forward.
Yeah, we are trying to mix it up next season. Next episode, we're going to go into it, but we're trying to do more variety of true crimes that span different years, different genres. You know, we like to mix it up here.
Different languages.
Exactly. First foreign film next season. Anyway, In Cold Blood premiered on December 14th, 1967, and grossed approximately $13 million domestically, with Truman Capote himself earning a 30% cut of the film's gross. After taxes and adjusting for inflation, between the book and the film, Capote netted about $34 million from In Cold Blood. Not too shabby.
No, until this, he wasn't poor, but he was not wealthy by any means. And then after this, the success of this book and movie, he was just ungodly wealthy and basically one of the most well-known people in the entire world.
Yeah, this film and book were huge successes, from my understanding. On Rotten Tomatoes, the film currently holds a rating of 83% with a critical consensus that reads, In Cold Blood is a classic docudrama with a fictional thriller's grip and a pair of terrific lead performances by Robert Blake and Scott Wilson. And I would agree with that. They were magnificent. And I do agree with the director that if they had casted someone like Frank Sinatra or Paul Newman, that would be distracting. And I would assume they would be playing the role of Dick, the more talkative, charismatic one. The film was also nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay, Best Cinematography, and Best Original Music Score. It did not win anything, though. Now, a fun little extra bit of true crime here. In May of 2001, actor Robert Blake, who portrayed Perry Smith in the film, was arrested and tried for the murder of his second wife, Bonnie Lee Bakley.
What?
I know, I knew you were going to like this. She had been murdered in the parking lot of an Italian restaurant where the couple had been eating dinner. After a multi-year trial that was heavily covered by tabloids, Blake was found not guilty in March 2005 for lack of evidence. However, in November of that same year, Blake was found liable for Bakley's death and in a civil suit was ordered to pay $30 million to Bakley's survivors. Blake would later go on to file for bankruptcy.
Who does that remind you of? Acquitted, but had to pay a big civil penalty for wrongful death.
I think it's a type of juice, but maybe apple juice?
OJ Simpson for our listeners.
Yes, I was too subtle with my with my apple juice joke. I'm sorry, everybody. But that was Richard Brooks's In Cold Blood film that was pleasantly surprising, exceeded all my expectations, was moving, powerful, brilliantly directed, brilliantly acted. Really a 10 out of 10 film. It's a really, really good movie, and I recommend it to anyone out there, even if you are not a fan of older films like this. I guarantee you this one. Wait it out for a bit. The beginning's a little rocky, but if you hang in there, you will be blown away by the end. I promise. I am very curious about the Capote side, the true side, if Capote side is the true side, of In Cold Blood. I want to hear it from you, Ashley. Can you tell me?
The Clutter family consisted of the patriarch, Herbert, the matriarch, Bonnie, and their four children, Eviana, Beverly, Nancy, and Kenyon. At the time of the murders, Nancy and Kenyon were the only two children living in the home. Eviana was married and living in Illinois, and Beverly was studying nursing in Kansas City. Both daughters, Eviana with her husband and 10-month-old, and Beverly with her fiancé, were expected to arrive to Holcomb in 2 weeks for Thanksgiving. In 1959, Holcomb was a small, dry, meaning no alcohol, town in western Kansas. Herbert Clutter graduated from Kansas State University with an agricultural degree. He used his education to build a 14-room estate on 80 acres of land, which was in addition to the 3,000 acres he rented out. His acreage was primarily wheat and similar crops, but the family also had a fruit orchard and livestock. One family lived nearby. Otherwise, there were no neighbors for half a mile. Mr. Clutter was one of Holcomb's most popular residents. He was highly respected, well-liked, a leader in the church community, and former chairman of the town's farmers' organization. Mr. and Mrs. Clutter had been married for 25 years at the time of their deaths. Bonnie was a slim woman who experienced postpartum depression after the births of each of her children. Postpartum can be very serious and typically worsens with each pregnancy, which was the case for Bonnie, as she was a frequent psychiatric patient since the early 1950s. Less than a week before the murders, she had actually returned from a two-week hospitalization at a medical center in Wichita. Nancy Clutter was a pretty and popular 16-year-old girl. She was in the midst of her first relationship with Bobby Rupp, the school's basketball star. She was a straight-A student, leader of the 4-H Club and Young Methodists League, and a skilled horseback rider, musician, and baker. Kenyon was 15 years old and the couple's only son. Saturday, November 14th, 1959, was a busy day for several members of the Clutter family. 48-year-old Mr. Clutter took out a $40,000 life insurance policy, which would double if he died by accidental means.
This actually did happen on the 14th, like the movie said. Wow, I was sure that that had been embellished for dramatic purposes.
Well, and this is interesting. He dies the next day. The person who had sold the policy hadn't, like, finalized it yet.
It was so soon. It was the same day, right?
It was the next day, and this was a Saturday. So it wasn't going to be, like, put in the bank or, you know, put in filed or whatever until that Monday. Technically, the organization didn't have to pay anything.
Did they, though?
They did. They paid the full $80,000.
Wow, insurance company coming through doing the right thing. That's good to hear.
That's kind of a running theme for the residents of Holcomb. For the Clutter funerals, a lot of family members came into town. All the residents in Holcomb opened up their homes. The family from out of state, they all had a place to stay for free.
That's good. The community really did seem to come together on this and try and help out any way that they could, which is very good to hear.
So Mr. Clutter took out this life insurance policy because he knew that Bonnie would be unable to maintain the farm in the event of his death due to her psychiatric difficulties. Nancy had several arrangements that afternoon and ended the evening watching television with Bobby and her family until he left around 10:30 or 11 at night. Sunday, November 15th, started out like any other day for the residents of Holcomb. The father of one of Nancy's friends dropped the girl off at the Clutter residence as she rode with them to church every Sunday. This day, however, no one answered the door when the girl knocked, despite both cars being in the driveway and a side door left partially ajar. This was suspicious, as Mr. Clutter never missed a Sunday service. After notifying another family who carpooled with the Clutters, all four people went into the house to investigate. Very little time elapsed before Nancy was discovered dead in her bedroom. Police were notified from the one nearby residence as the phone lines in the Clutter home had been severed. The investigation revealed a gruesome scene. The women were bound and covered in their respective beds. Both had died from close-range gunshot wounds to their heads. Kenyon and Mr. Clutter were found in adjacent rooms in the basement. Kenan was bound and gagged on the couch with a pillow under his head, possibly to make him more comfortable before he was shot in the head. Mr. Clutter was dead on a large cardboard mattress box with his ankles tied and tape over his face. He had his throat cut and he was also shot in the face. Upon initial glance, robbery didn't appear to be a motive because nothing of value seemed to be missing. It was assumed at least two people were involved, with at least one of them having intimate knowledge of the layout of the home. Very little evidence was discovered at the scene. There were two shoe prints, one in blood and another in dust, and a piece of cord tied to a steam pipe above Mr. Clutter, which led investigators to believe that he was tied up to the pipe at some point. Nancy's boyfriend Bobby was the prime suspect, as he was the last known person to see the family alive, but he was quickly eliminated. The two surviving daughters were quickly ruled out as they were miles away. The following day, three of Mr. Clutter's closest friends assembled to clean the crime scene, which involved burning blood-soaked bedding, mattresses, rugs, and stuffed animals.
Wait, what?
Yeah, they just went in and burned all this stuff. I'm assuming because the lack of, like, forensic evidence, but I think they could still do some sort of blood typing, couldn't they?
I am not sure. I would assume that you would try and hang on to that evidence and not get rid of it as soon as possible, but maybe the town was just anxious to move past this? I don't know.
I'm not sure, but it was all burned.
I know another family did move into the home, and they were paid by the filmmakers to use the house, so it was not an empty, abandoned house after this. Another family did move in.
The coroner estimated the times of death to be between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m., and the Kansas Bureau of Investigation sent several detectives to help investigate. 1,000 people attended the Clutter family memorial service. The KBI took the opportunity to interview everyone in town who knew the family. The townsfolk gave the names of three people who would have some motive to kill Mr. Clutter, but each provided verifiable alibis. During another search of the home about 5 to 7 days after the murder, a family member noticed that Kenyon's radio was missing and found a gold watch tucked deep inside one of Nancy's shoes. This led the investigators to believe that robbery was a primary motive. In December, a strange man was found prowling inside the Clutter residence. He told officers he read about the case and decided to check out the scene on his way to Mexico. He was arrested for having a shotgun in his car, but he was soon determined to not be involved in the slayings.
This was included in the movie. I did not include it in my synopsis. In the movie, he is referred to as an escaped mental patient.
I think in reality, he was just like a homeless transient.
Okay, that would make more sense. I was skeptical that an escaped mental patient had tried to sneak into this crime scene during all this, but apparently someone did, just not a mental patient.
700 tips were investigated across the United States and Mexico until detectives finally got their first real lead in mid-December. The lead came from a prisoner serving a short sentence for burglary at the Kansas State Penitentiary. Floyd Wells told detectives he knew who committed the murder immediately after reading about them a few days after they happened. But he was worried he would be labeled as a snitch or charged as an accessory to the crime. Thankfully, he confided in a religious prisoner who encouraged him to report the information he had, which he did so immediately. Floyd relayed how he briefly worked on the Clutter farm for a year while drifting around the country a decade prior. Upon arriving in prison, he celled with Richard Dick Hickok, who was paroled a few months later. Dick told Floyd about his parole plans to impersonate an Air Force officer in Nevada and seek opportunities for easy, fast cash with the help of his prior cellmate, Perry Smith, if needed.
More charm scams. It sounds like something out of Catch Me If You Can.
I'm not sure why, but during these conversations, Floyd mentioned Mr. Clutter, which immediately piqued Dick's interest. He asked all about the family's wealth, the layout of the house, and the location of a potential safe. He then talked about how he planned to rob the home with Perry and kill all the witnesses. Floyd incorrectly assumed this was all talk. After learning about Dick and Perry, investigators spoke to Dick's parents in Olathe, Kansas, which was 400 miles away from Holcomb. They were not told about the true intention of the visit. They assumed their son was in some sort of trouble, as he lived with them until he left without warning a few days after the Clutters were murdered. They also told Detective about Dick's new friend and Kansas occupant, Perry. A recently purchased 12-gauge shotgun was found in the home and seized. While in Olathe, I apologize if I'm saying this town's name wrong, I'm sure I am, investigators learned about a string of bad checks written in the area around the time of Dick's last sighting. Several stores provided descriptions of the crooks. Detectives tracked Perry's last known address to Vegas and issued warrants for their arrests. They spoke to Perry's only living sister in San Francisco, who said she had not heard from Perry in 4 years, but she knew he briefly stayed with their father in Alaska before he was kicked out following a violent altercation. And Remy, this is the altercation that you described at the end of the movie. She asked to have her location concealed because she was afraid of Perry. On December 30th, investigators got word that Perry picked up a box at a post office in Vegas. Both men were arrested 3 days later for what they assumed were parole violations due to their check writing scheme. Their shoe prints matched the two found at the crime scene. Both men were twice interrogated separately. Initially, they both relayed similar stories about visiting Perry's sister to pick up some cash, writing some bad checks in Kansas, and then fleeing to Mexico. They claimed they spent their time in Mexico partying until they were robbed and came back to the States. Interrogators confronted each man about the murders during the second round of interrogations, claiming they had a witness. Dick obviously knew who this witness was, Floyd Wells. Dick then signed a written confession stating Perry killed each family member after the men did not find a safe with $10,000 as expected. Perry's confession spilled out en route to Holcomb. During that lengthy drive, he provided specific details about what happened prior to, after, and during the gruesome early morning hours of November 15th, 1959.
This flashback occurs in the film also on this car ride. Again, I thought this was done for dramatic purposes, but it sounds accurate yet again.
Before we get into what happened that night and the subsequent events, let's talk about who Perry Smith and Dick Hickok were. 31-year-old Perry Smith was one of four children born to Tex and Flo, which were nicknames. The family was rarely in one place as Tex and Flo worked the rodeo circuit until they were forced to retire due to physical ailments when Perry was five.
Tex and Flo's Rodeo Show.
It's a really catchy and great rodeo name.
It's a great name, I gotta say. Yeah, it's very memorable.
The family spent the next year traveling around the country in an old truck while Tex and Flo searched for employment. The family was extremely poor. The children rarely had appropriate clothing or shoes and were often fed rotten bananas or stale bread soaked in condensed milk. That sounds so gross.
Why would you even bother? I would eat anything else. Oh my God.
Flo had a drinking problem. Often invited other men into her bedroom when Tex was out of town, and both parents engaged in severe domestic violence. After a particularly brutal altercation involving horsewhips, scalding water, and kerosene lamps, Flo took all the children with her to San Francisco. The next 3 years of six-year-old Perry's life were even more unpleasant. Flo drank heavily, rarely supervised the children, and engaged in sex work. Perry hated his mother, ran away several times in search of his father, and started hanging out with a group of older delinquent teens. He was placed in numerous juvenile detention centers, primarily for theft, and at least two group homes. The latter because Flo either couldn't care for Perry or just didn't want to. He was frequently abused at these group homes. For example, he had talked about how nuns would beat him every time he wet the bed and even put some ointment on his penis that would cause it to burn.
This was also included in the film, not visually, but Perry does speak about the nuns and some of their abuse towards him and fantasizes that they are attacked by a giant glowing golden bird.
After Perry caught pneumonia when he was held in a bathtub until he turned blue, his father came back into the picture. Although Tex was awarded custody of all four of his children, he put the other three in various homes as this was during the Great Depression and he couldn't provide for them all. Tex then constructed a primitive RV out of a trailer, and he and Perry traveled around the country for the next 6 years, never staying in one place for very long. Eventually, Perry and Tex settled in Alaska. Perry hitchhiked to Seattle and joined the Merchant Marines at the age of 16. He transitioned to the Army and was deployed to Japan and Korea a few years later. During this time in the military, he was court-martialed for demolishing a cafe, stealing a taxi, and throwing a Japanese policeman off a bridge.
Were all of these crimes connected to the same event?
No, these were all different crimes.
Okay, I was going to say.
He planned to return to Alaska after he was somehow honorably discharged in 1952, but he was hospitalized for 6 months for injuries sustained during a motorcycle accident. The injuries to his legs resulted in permanent scarring and chronic pain. After he was released from the hospital, he spent another 6 months recovering in the home of a Native American logger and fisherman who befriended him. He then returned to Alaska to help his father build a large hunting lodge. Although the lodge opened at the end of 1953, it seldom drew visitors, and tensions between Perry and Tex rose until Perry was kicked out in April 1954 following this violent altercation. He spent the next year traveling around the country until he was arrested and sentenced to 5 to 10 years for larceny, escape, and car theft, time of which was served at the Kansas State Penitentiary. It was here where he met and celled with Dick Hickok. Unlike Perry, 28-year-old Dick's upbringing was much more pleasant. Dick was an outstanding athlete and excelled in school. He dreamed of going to college to study engineering, but his family couldn't afford tuition. He married and had 3 children with a 16-year-old girl when he was 19, but the marriage ended after he fathered a child with another woman 6 years later. I'm assuming that one is the son he referenced.
I think so.
Similar to Perry, Dick was also involved in a serious motor vehicle accident in 1950. He suffered a serious head injury, which resulted in fainting spells and periods of spontaneous bleeding from his nose and ears, which I didn't even know you could bleed from the ears spontaneously, for the rest of his life.
That would be really worrying.
Some sources say, like, his face was also disfigured. Like, he just kind of looked off. Like, his face wasn't as proportionate as it was before the accident.
Okay, I've only seen pictures of him post-accident, I assume. But he looked fine to me.
Yeah, I thought he looked fine too, but yeah. It was pointed out a couple times in the book. This head injury likely contributed to Dick's impulsivity and gambling habit. To make matters worse, he and his second wife quickly fell into debt as they lived way above their means, buying expensive cars and houses they could not afford. This is when Dick developed his habit of writing fraudulent checks. His wife left him while he was serving time at the Kansas State Pen for burglary. Perry and Dick were paroled in July and August 1959, just 3 and 4 months before the Clutter murders. Dick returned to live with his parents and worked as a mechanic. Perry appears to have gone to Las Vegas for a bit after his release. At this time in his life, he only had 2 living relatives, Tex and 1 sister. Flo died in 1955 following an alcohol-induced coma, and his 2 other siblings died by suicide.
That's horrible. Jesus, yeah. The siblings are not touched upon after they leave in the film.
The suicides are really sad. 1 sibling just threw herself off a window of her apartment, and another one came home and found his wife had committed suicide, so he killed himself too.
Oh my God, that's insanely tragic. Jesus, oh man.
Perry planned to return to Kansas to reunite with another cellmate, but he actually reunited with Dick as the other cellmate left the state just 5 hours earlier. Think how different this could have been. That other prisoner was the, like, prison pastor or something like that.
That was the phone call he made at the beginning of the film. He was trying to reach another prisoner and could not get a hold of them. And at the end of the film, he meets back up with that reverend and actually mentions, could you imagine how all of this would have played out if I had actually met up with so-and-so and not Dick?
Yeah, and he only missed him by 5 hours.
Yeah, the film makes it seem like Perry was waiting around for quite a while at that bus station, too. So how differently things could have potentially gone.
Dick and Perry met to discuss a plan involving a large sum of cash on Saturday, November 14th, 1959, just 2 days after Perry arrived in Kansas. It was during this lunch when Perry learned about Dick's plan to rob and kill the Clutter family while pretending to be hunters asking to use their phone. After Dick told his parents that he would be accompanying Perry to pick up money from Perry's sister, he loaded his shotgun, extra ammunition, flashlight, fishing knife, leather gloves, and hunting vest in the car, and the duo started driving. They stopped to purchase more gloves and rope. Perry wanted to buy stockings to conceal their faces, but Dick insisted that wouldn't be necessary as no witnesses would be left alive.
This is also mentioned in the film. Perry is quite upset that they could not get the stockings, and Dick claimed that they didn't have black stockings, which was the reason why he didn't get them. He didn't want the beige colored stockings for whatever reason. He had a preference.
Yeah, Perry actually was successful in convincing Dick to stop at a hospital to try to find these stockings, and Dick came out and said they didn't have any, but Perry always suspected that Dick didn't even ask.
He mentions that they should try this in the film, and in the film, Dick just kind of waves it off. It would have been unnecessary to visually show him stopping and pretending to not get anything.
The two men arrived in Holcomb during the late night hours of Saturday, November 14th. They crept into the dark home and started searching for the supposed safe. After Mr. Clutter was accidentally awoken by a flashlight, he told the men there was no safe and offered to write them a check as he never carried cash. Perry cut the phone lines and the pair went upstairs where Mrs. Clutter was asked about the alleged safe. Dick pocketed $40 to $50 found in purses and wallets, but he refused to believe that there wasn't a large sum of cash hidden somewhere in this huge house. Mr. Clutter and Kenyon were tied up in the basement while Nancy and Mrs. Clutter were bound in their respective bedrooms. Perry instructed Dick to continue to look for the safe after he discovered him talking to young Nancy in her bedroom. You see, Perry was aware of and disgusted by Dick's sexual interest in young girls. Years later, Dick would confess to being a pedophile, and he would say that he knew there would be a young girl in the home that night whom he intended to rape, but Perry stopped him. After Dick left, Perry tucked Nancy in and promised her and her mother that he would not let Dick hurt anyone. Although Perry always contended that he hoped the robbery could be done without violence, he was the one who shot each family member in the face one by one. Dick and Perry drove back to Olathe after the murders. Upon reading a newspaper article about the slayings about a week later, they decided it was time to make their way to Mexico. They gathered enough money for their trip by paying for various items with bad checks and pawning the merchandise. The men spent the end of November and most of December traveling around Mexico, fishing, drinking, having sex with women, but they eventually ran out of money and decided to search for employment back in the States. They hitchhiked back to Kansas, wrote a few more bad checks, and then stole a car. They then traveled around for another week or so until they were apprehended in Vegas and extradited back to Kansas on January 6, 1960.
I still can't believe they came back from Mexico. They were gone for such a long time. It seems like a crazy decision to come back. Were they unaware of the amount of press and attention this crime had received at the time? Do you know?
I'm not sure. I'm assuming they thought that they didn't leave any witnesses. They didn't leave much behind. There was no way the crime could be linked to them. Dick's reason for wanting to come back to the States is that he couldn't find employment in Mexico, and the employment he could find paid nothing.
And I'm assuming the check scam could not work in Mexico. Different banks, different currency. All of that sort of thing. So yeah, I don't think it would work the same for him.
The jail in Holcomb was incredibly tiny and actually adjoined to the sheriff's personal kitchen. Since the two men needed to be kept apart, Perry was placed in the kitchen, adjacent cell, typically reserved for female prisoners. The sheriff's wife was responsible for doing all the cooking, sewing, and laundry for the prisoners, which at max capacity would only be 6 people. The wife took somewhat of a liking to Perry. She often asked him what he wanted to eat for dinner and gave him old issues of Good Housekeeping to read. She was also impressed by Perry's ability to train a squirrel to play with a paper ball, beg for scraps, and sit on his shoulder. The squirrel actually remained in the cell for a little bit after Perry was transported to prison.
Oh, I wish that was in the movie. It would have been too hard to pull off back when the film was made, though, so I can understand. No CGI and hard to train a squirrel, I would assume.
I would assume. I'm pretty impressed. Like, he trained it to do several things.
There aren't a lot of movies with trained squirrels. I know there was a bad Johnny Depp, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory movie that had trained squirrels, but beyond that, I think it is a rarity in Hollywood.
Throughout January 1960, Perry told investigators about other evidence, such as where they sold Kenyon's radio and a set of binoculars, both of which were later found at a pawn shop, and the location of the buried shotgun shells, leftover tape, and rope. All of those items were found and further linked Dick and Perry to the crime. Mid-month, the DA announced that they would be seeking the death penalty and would not be considering a plea. Likely because there were few options for the defense, Dick and Perry's lawyers announced their intent to pursue the insanity plea. To qualify for that, Kansas statute at the time stated the defendants would have had to not know that murder was wrong. Interesting fact, Kansas is actually one of, I think it's very few, it's like five or something states that actually completely abolished the insanity plea after John Hinckley.
Really? So it's not even an option if you're imprisoned in Kansas now. You cannot say it was because of insanity.
Not to plead not guilty by reason of insanity. You can still present evidence of mental illness and its impact on the crime, which might lead the court to consider a reduced kind of type of the crime, like a reduced severity. But you can't just get not guilty because of a mental illness.
Okay, interesting.
Three evaluators later determined that neither defendant had a mental illness, and thus they did not qualify for the insanity plea. There was one expert witness for the defense who did think the men had mental health issues, primarily this weird psychotic disorder, but he was barred from testifying, probably because his opinion was crap.
This is the person who said that they would form one personality from their two separate personalities whenever they would meet up.
It sounds like that wasn't exactly what he said, but it was kind of like they were thrust into this psychotic episode during the crime. The defense briefly considered asking for a change of venue, as obviously this crime was very well known. But they concluded that the best bet at avoiding a death sentence would be to keep the trial in Holcomb, as it was a highly religious community, and even the pastor was preaching against the death penalty. The trial started on March 23, 1960. Four jurors and the judge were actually acquainted some way with Mr. Clutter. Each party said their association wouldn't hinder their ability to reach an impartial verdict. This would never fly today.
You know, you just take their word for it. They knew him, but just casually.
And the judge.
Yeah, that wouldn't sway anyone's opinion whatsoever, having actually known the victim.
After 4 days of testimony, the jury only took 40 minutes to render a guilty verdict and death sentence. Before leaving the courtroom, both men laughed after Perry stated that the jury were not chicken-hearted. Dick and Perry returned to Kansas State Pen, this time on death row. Their execution was originally set for May 1960, but numerous appeals repeatedly delayed the date.
Kind of a side question here. They were tried together, right? How does that work? I really don't understand how there are some people who are tried separately, yet others are tried as a pair or even a group. It seems like Dick was not the murderer. He was definitely involved. He was definitely accessory to murder. It just seems odd that they were tried together when it was very clear from confessions and Dick's statement as well. Perry was the one who pulled the trigger and killed every member of the family single-handedly.
In most states, to be convicted of a crime, you don't actually have to be doing it. You just have to have been involved in some way. Dick was clearly involved in some way. They were charged as co-defendants together. His attorneys probably could have petitioned the court to get their trials severed from each other, which you can do if you have co-defendants and is often done a lot of the time. But it wasn't in this case for whatever reason. In June 1960, Perry stopped eating or talking and was given a feeding tube in the prison hospital. Over the next 9 weeks, he lost 50 pounds. He was like 115 pounds or something, and slipped into a coma. He finally started eating again in September and returned to his cell the following month. Two other men were executed from 1960 to 1962. Where their death row was, like their death row prison cell was at, it was at the very, very top. And you couldn't see the gallows. Like, you could pretty much see where the hangings took place, but you could hear the trapdoor. And it was apparently very, very loud and ominous.
This is referenced in the film. And the gallows in the prison in the film, I don't know if this is what the real one was called, but they refer to the gallows as the corner. So whenever someone was going there, they would say they're taking him to the corner.
It's so dark.
It's very dark and ominous, yeah.
The men were allowed out of their cell once a week to shower and change clothes. This is Kansas. This is the Midwest. Can you imagine how freaking hot it was and how smelly you would be in these like dark, damp cells and only allowed to change clothes once a week? That's disgusting.
It sounds horrendous. I couldn't imagine.
Otherwise, all they could do was sleep, paint, which only Perry did, read, and work on their appeals.
Perry is shown painting in his cell in the film as well, and he's shown to be quite the talented artist, actually.
Their unsuccessful appeals primarily revolved around the possibility of a biased jury, ineffective assistance of counsel, and illegal seizure of evidence related to the gun that they took from Dick's parents' home. After all of these appeals failed, they made a last-ditch effort and petitioned for clemency, which they were denied. On April 15th, 1965, 20 people, including Truman Capote at the request of Dick and Perry, gathered to witness the execution. They ate their last meal of shrimp, fries, garlic bread, and ice cream with strawberries and whipped cream. I guess I should say Dick ate his last meal, as Perry barely touched his food. 33-year-old Richard Hickok was taken to the gallows first. He shook the hands of the four KBI detectives and looked disappointed when he was told no member of the Clutter family was present. His last statement was, "I just want to say I hold no hard feelings. You people are sending me to a better world than this ever was." He was pronounced dead at 12:41 a.m. 36-year-old Perry Smith's last words were, "I think it's a hell of a thing to take a life in this manner. I don't believe in capital punishment. Morally or legally. Maybe I did something to contribute something. It would be meaningless to apologize for what I did, even inappropriate, but I do apologize." He was pronounced dead at 1:19 a.m. And that is the true story of Richard Brooks's In Cold Blood. What'd you think, Remy?
I think it sounds incredibly accurate. It sounds like a lot of the details, a lot of things that I didn't even include in my synopsis were parts of their life and the story was included in just casual conversations, just parts where they were driving. They would bring up all of these things that you mentioned when you were talking about their past. The few changes that I did notice do not seem to be anything substantial that would really alter anyone's perception of the story in general. I thought it's a very harrowing tale, and I find it very interesting that we were able to get inside these two men's heads as well, that we were given the opportunity to try and analyze them and find out who they are and maybe things that happened in their life that shaped them and created the person that became and committed these horrendous acts.
I agree. I did notice some small differences, like the detectives finding the shotgun at Perry's father's house instead of Dick's.
I want to chime in on this. It very well could have been Dick's father's house. The film is in black and white. Dick's father is not really shown at the beginning. It's from behind. He's huddled over. You can't really see his face. And the scene where they find the shotgun and knife is extremely brief. I may have mistook one old man in a shack for another old man in a shack. So I believe that that actually was correct in the film, and it was my mistake that I realized while you were telling your story. Obviously, I mistook the different actors. I apologize. I am calling it out before the episode ends, thankfully. That was my mistake. I confused two old actors that were both living in shacks.
Well, then in that case, there's even more similarities than differences. I think the main big differences, which is actually what Truman Capote had said he didn't like about the film, is that there wasn't enough focus on the Clutter family itself, who they were as people, and it left out a lot of Dick and Perry's childhood. But otherwise, if you put all that in, I mean, there's so many details in the book. I always go through while I'm reading and highlight things. On this book, I had more highlighted than not because Truman Capote does not waste a word with details, and there's just no way you can put all of that stuff in a movie. The director tried with these flashbacks and I think took some big parts about at least Perry's childhood to kind of show how he grew to be this killer, even if sometimes maybe those attempts did fall a little flat.
Yes, I believe that there are a lot of instances where they are telling instead of showing. They're just having conversations and they're mentioning stuff from their past. Dick mentioning his child, Perry mentioning the nuns. I feel like it does work. There were a lot of moments where these two men were having these conversations, and I'm assuming maybe that is how they got to know one another and we learn it the same way they did. And the moments where we do flashback are almost hallucinations. They almost don't seem real. There's a trippiness to them and a tragicness. I feel like it is done very well. There is a lot of parts where they're just saying everything, but the actors do a tremendous job of telling the stories of the real life events.
Well, I have a feeling we both know how we're going to rank this movie, but it is time to do just that. Quick rundown, at the end of each episode, we give the movie a little ranking based on how true to the real life events it was. If we feel like the movie was pretty much spot on and there wasn't a lot changed and it has the essence of the actual crime that inspired it, then it gets a not guilty rating. If we feel like there are some pretty major differences, but a lot of the backbones are in place, it'll get a mistrial. And lastly, if it is just completely unrecognizable from the events it is claiming to take inspiration from, then it will get a guilty verdict. Remy, what does In Cold Blood get?
I think it's no surprise on this one. This film gets a not guilty verdict from me. Set this film free. It is done amazing and changed my opinion on how older films are, actually. I'm going to look into some other films around this time period and from Richard Brooks specifically, because he really knocked it out of the park. The attention to detail is crazy. And I always mention this when a true crime film goes above and beyond to try and go to locations and capture that authenticity aspect. This film went further than any film we have covered this entire season. They actually went to the home where this family died. They had photos of them. They had the straps that the killers were hung in. It's mind-boggling to even think about, so yes, a very extreme not guilty for me. How about you, Ashley? What is your verdict on this?
I completely agree. I can't even see someone really entertaining another verdict other than not guilty. It just really followed the book pretty beautifully. And we will get into next week in our episode about Capote, his role in the researching of this crime. Why he became interested in it in the first place, the research he did with his BFF Harper Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. This is like my favorite fact about him. He was childhood best friends with Harper Lee. And then we'll also talk about the aftermath of this, both what it did to him financially and also psychologically. This book was his baby, but it also was his downfall.
Yes, I'm very excited about this one. I have seen Capote. I think it's a brilliant film as well. It's very different than In Cold Blood. Capote, the film, is really held up entirely by Philip Seymour Hoffman's brilliant performance. Rest in peace. I am excited to learn more about it. I know that Capote did get to know one of the killers, Perry, very intimately towards the end while he was on death row. I'm interested to know more about this story. This has really been something that I feel like I learned a lot, and there is a reason why this launched true crime into what it became. This is a fascinating, tragic story that was conveyed brilliantly.
And yes, that will be next week for our season one finale. We actually already have episodes picked out for season two. So if you come back and listen to our season finale next week, we'll give you a little snippet of what to expect in the following months. Until then, please, if you enjoy what you are hearing, give us a like, give us a rating, give us a comment on whatever podcast platform you are hearing this from.
Hopefully good comments and reviews, please. We're going to share the good ones. We may share the negative ones someday, but first we want to get some confidence boost. So we're going to reward anyone who is enjoying this show and gives it a positive rating with reading out their names next season.
Also, keep an eye out on the episode description for these. We are going to be making little Instagram posts that will have actual pictures comparing some of the real life people to their cinematic portrayals. So that will be kind of fun. And we will also post any links to other social media platforms that we get up and running.
Yes, a lot to come. And thank you all so much for coming along with us. We sincerely appreciate it. I am really enjoying this. This has just been something we decided to do for fun. We have no idea if this show is going to do well or not, but we sincerely thank you for listening. And we're going to keep on doing it because this is fun. And thank you guys so much. We'll see you next week for Capote.
Until then.